Once forged in the fires of PR and journalism, Curtis Dewar and Corey Westbrook united to create C-Squared. Now, on our podcast, we interview musicians and other industry professionals to give you an inside look on how to take your music to the next level.
Hello, everyone. You are listening to the C-Squared podcast with Corey and Curtis. We are here today with the CEO, the guy, the dude, the whatever he wants to be called from Unique Leader, Mr. Jamie Graham. And we are super excited to have him on the podcast today to share his unique wisdom as a unique leader in this industry. I'm so sorry, Jamie. Curtis probably didn't warn you that like puns are my lifeblood prior to you coming onto this. But yeah, there will be several corny jokes throughout this show. So before we get started, though, I do just want to say thank you for joining us and thank you for braving the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. Yeah, looking forward to it. Corny jokes aside, well, looking forward to those as well.
Oh, he's looking forward to my corny jokes, folks. You heard it here first. Somebody appreciates my humor. Take that, Curtis. Anyway, so for those who may not be familiar with who you are and what you do, do you want to just give like a brief intro nutshell version of what you're all about? I'm sure that's a coconut sized nut to like jam all of that in there, but just some tidbits for the listeners.
So currently spearheading Unique Leader, been working there for a few years now. I was shadowing Eric, kind of handling a lot of the label management and the A&R stuff, product management. And then when Eric sadly passed, I took over from there. So that was 2019, early 2019, I took it over because he passed on in October 2018. So that was a bit of a crazy few years, really. For many, many reasons, obviously, but taking sort of a legacy that he'd been working on for best part of 20 years plus, and something that was obviously very well respected within the death metal scene. I had a lot of pressure to sort of ensure that that legacy was continued and not soiled and stuff. And there were already a lot of sort of split communities about what the label was about, where the roster was heading, and some of the decisions that Eric had made with the roster before, like branching out into different genres. I think the ones that sort of ruffled the most feathers were the deathcore bands, because sort of back then it wasn't as much of a accepted subgenre standing side by side with like the tech death stuff and the slamming brutal stuff. So but yeah, before Unique Leader, I was at Sumerian for a couple of years doing the international operations there, and before that I was at Century Media for several years, because I had an imprint through them that was since 2007, I think, and then before that I was at Terrorizer magazine doing the sort of brand advertising stuff, sponsorships, music licensing for the cover mount CDs, things like that. And then the first job I had in the biz was One Little Indian Records, which at the time was like the home for Bjork and Skunk Anansie and a few other really cool indie bands. So that was just a good way to get started, you know? So yeah, it's pretty much all I've done really since I left school. I think the first job I got in the biz was in 2000. So yeah, 22 years it'll be now. Fuck.
So let's kind of get kind of like in depth with you on it. So like, how did you actually first get involved in the industry then? Because you said you started when you first got out of school. So like, what kind of led you to being able to get your first job, I guess?
Well, I did audio engineering and like a couple of additional modules for uni. So I sort of came out wanting to work in a recording studio, and then I had an interest in music licensing and the sort of contractual side. So there wasn't really like an intention at the beginning to go straight into label stuff. It was more just to be involved in the process of making records, like directly involved. Yeah. But then I found I was doing less engineering and more actual producing with bands, sort of helping develop them and sort of working with them on their songs and stuff. And that turned more into you know, how are we going to promote this and how should we get this person or that person? And I guess when you're sort of young and hungry, you've got that thirst to do a lot more networking. Mm-hmm. You don't mind sort of going to shows after work during the week and things like that, and then repeating it on the weekend, whilst now I just want to put my feet up and watch Gogglebox. So it's a bit different. Yeah, I mean, it was sort of a baptism of fire, really. It was a bit of a different industry back then as well, because it was pre Napster and LimeWire and all of that, and obviously quite a long time before Spotify and Apple Music and all of the sort of main DSPs we've got now. So one thing I've learned is, you know, a lot of the sort of consistent practices do remain the same, but it's just a question of how you evolve and adapt to it, and how you can make your model of your business adapt with it without sort of being a dinosaur label, as I like to call it, where you're just kind of still working to a contract model that was offered like 15, 20 years ago. They don't really apply in this day and age. So yeah, I guess the point where I sort of transitioned from like working with people on a team and sort of learning about the process to actually running a label was 2006. And then since then, it's been like an even steeper learning curve, because you come in knowing the practices of people in other departments and you talk to people at work and you see what they do. But when it comes to actually doing it all yourself, you know, some stuff you learn the hard way and other stuff you take to really quickly. So that was equally like, it was a double-edged sword. On one side, it was great because I got to sort of get involved in every part of the industry quite early in the whole process of releasing records. But on the other side, it was difficult because obviously you're competing with, you know, people who are very good at what they do, or departments that are very good at what they do. And you can't really sort of stand toe to toe and say, well, you know, we can do as well as X, Y, and Z label when you're just starting out. So the idea at the beginning was just find a couple of bands that we're into and just push those and just see where it went. So yeah, I guess I kind of fell in love with it. It's like a labor of love and hate at the same time. And I don't really know how to do anything else, so I've just stuck doing this.
Now, just to follow up on that. So just to make sure, hopefully I got your timeline correctly when I'm asking here. So it was Century Media you started with before Sumerian, correct?
Yeah, so I had a label called Siege of Amida, or Saw for short, and that got bought by Century, along with a few other imprints before they got bought outright by Sony. So yeah. Century obviously went to Sony a couple of years ago. So yeah, that was the first instance of sort of building my own roster and sort of building a release schedule and doing things the way I sort of wanted to do them. But before then, I got quite a bit of experience just seeing people like Derek Burke at work, or like Michelle Polly and people like that, who are still very much in the industry and still very much at the top of their game like 20 years later. So I was lucky enough to learn from some good people, and I also worked for some real characters as well over the years, where some practices you're like, wow, I love the way they do this, and then other stuff you think, well, I'm never going to do it like that. So you know, in that respect, I had some pretty cool sort of mentors and people to sort of compare stuff to, and I wasn't just at one label from start to finish. You know, if you're just with one team, you only really get one method of working. For example, there's a big difference between how a German label works and how an American label works, just in general, like the whole practice and the way the back end works and staff procedures and deadlines and the way they organize everything. It's like chalk and cheese. So I'm trying to sort of find that middle ground, I guess, like a hot dog with some German mustard on it.
So just to clarify before we get into the next question, though, so now, how you must have been pretty young when you first started running the labels then, so how is it kind of like, you kind of go from like, how does it feel to kind of like transition into being the boss and running the label when I'm assuming you were like 23, 24, unless the timelines are off for me?
I was 22 started my label, but in terms of, I mean, anyone can start a label, you know, and say, oh, I've got a label. But in terms of when we actually had a roster that was, you know, making enough for the label to be sort of our full-time job and to have staff and all that stuff, I guess it was 2008 it would have been, because mm-hmm. By that point we had like Whitechapel, we had Annotations of an Autopsy, Knights of the Abyss, Impending Doom, Viatrophy, I think off the top of my head, like Discarnate. There's a bunch of bands that were doing pretty well. And then, I met Robert at Century Media, who was the CEO at the time. And we were just chatting music for ages over some food and stuff and got sort of pretty pissed and sort of had like semi-heated debates over which era of thrash or death metal was better and shit like that. So mm-hmm. It just started with that, really. And I guess the more campaigns I worked, the more sort of rope I was given, the budgets went up and stuff. And then I guess the first position with a bit more, I would want to say responsibility, because I guess that was always there, but in terms of managing larger budgets, where if I fucked up, you know, it would be a serious problem for mm-hmm. other people, I guess that would be the Sumerian stuff, just because that was all of their markets outside of America. But in terms of jumping from that to Unique Leader, like that was just, I wasn't expecting such a handover, obviously, in the circumstances in the way it happened was just horrific and stuff. And we were all just really taken back for a good year, trying to kind of adjust to life without Eric, because it was just weird, because it's like KFC without the Colonel, you know? So I sort of grabbed it by the horns a bit and just sort of thought, well, there's certain things that I want to leave intact. And then there's other things that we were working on already that I just sort of went full steam with. And we're here now.
Yeah. Cool. Corey, do you want to give any more follow-up on that before we go into the next one?
No, I think that's actually a good segue into the next one, because we can get more specific on like what your role is at Unique Leader, what you tend to do, like your day-to-day deal at Unique Leader.
Okay.
Well, your unique responsibilities at Unique Leader. I'm so, okay.
Well, when I first started, it was basically is A&R, product management, and helping Eric with actually running the label itself, like, you know, accounts and timelines and release schedules and all that stuff, helping him manage that side of things. And then as his health deteriorated, I took on more. But things like, you know, the contractual side as well, and licensing, you know, all the boring stuff really that he didn't want to do, mm-hmm. which is where it should have been, really. Like, he'd earned the right to start delegating. But when I took it over, I sort of was handling everything apart from like the video content creation stuff and the actual building of the artwork product, you know, like the layouts for CDs and vinyl, all that stuff. But once we had the product, I was essentially handling all of it. We had a couple of members of staff that were, one was handling like the social media, but I've taken that over since, because he's gone to another label for like a fairly executive position now. And then we also had someone else doing the marketing, who was also doing mucking in a little bit. But as far as full-time team and stuff, like for the first couple of years, it was just me and Matty, really. And then as we built it, I guess we're at what, 13, 14 staff now.
Oh, wow.
So it's changed quite a lot over the last few years. And we brought a few people on board for sort of in-house content creation that we think are like the top of their field, like Kaelin for our art department and Scott for videos. And we brought in a few more marketing people that are really good at what they're doing and stuff, and the PR team. And so we're just trying to sort of, you know, I'm trying to take like the things that I learned from other labels I've worked at, and things that I think could have been implicated that weren't, and trying to kind of combine that within the model we've got without overstretching ourselves too much. But yeah, you just got to just go for it, I think. If you play this conservatively, then you're just playing in the hands of the platforms that you're releasing everything with. Like, you have to be aggressive and sort of establish your own roster and sound, which I think Eric was really successful with, particularly you know, throughout the sort of, I'd say from sort of 2006 to like 2011, the releases that were coming out on Unique Leader were, it was sort of the pinnacle of brutal and technical death metal. So I think the best, most of those bands within those genres have now kind of peaked and they've set a standard that I don't think is going to be hit again. So we're just focusing on other genres as well now and trying to keep the legacy acts on the, you know, the reputation that the label's already got. But we don't plan on slowing down either. I think the roster will probably be twice the size it is in 10 years, I imagine.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
How many releases do you guys do per year on average, would you say?
I'd say between 20 and 25.
Cool. Moment. Cool.
Yeah.
So just back to just your responsibilities as a CEO for a minute here. So it's more like, so basically just so people understand, like you don't necessarily handle the signings direct, correct? Or am I mistaken?
No, I do. Yeah.
You do?
Okay. My duties at the moment, I do. So A&R, management of the label itself, artist development, brand development, contracts, royalty administration, licensing, marketing, sync, product management.
So just all of the things.
All of it.
Well, it's the stuff that kind of needs to be done at the very beginning where we can sort of set up a decent timeline and marketing plan with the rest of the team. And then once a release is set, I'll sort of let the team go off and do their thing and then it'll be on to the next release. But there's always a sort of checking in process to make sure that releases are where they should be. So we have like regular catch-ups between us and stuff to make sure that everything's on point. But yeah, it was ridiculous at one point. I was, you know, we were juggling like 50 bands between two of us doing everything. It's just nuts.
Yeah. So now just on that then. So then if you've got all those duties then that, or like how much time per day do you have to spend running the label?
I'm not even gonna it's just all the time. Like my phone's always in my hand. My missus is fucking had a wits and you know, out of wits end with it. But it's constant. Like you can't really I think with something like this without sounding cliche, like if you want like a 9-to-5, then just forget it, do something else.
Yeah.
You have to sort of live and breathe it and really be into it. Otherwise it doesn't come across as sincere. Especially when you're talking to bands about, you know, the direction you think that they should take. And if it's maybe not the exact decision they've made, you've got to justify why. You can't just base it on like, well, I don't think I want to do that this weekend because, you know, I've got to do this or I'm going out for dinner or nah, you got to be there. So that's why I brought more staff on board, because it was literally getting to the point where I was having weird dreams about Excel sheets and stuff.
I've been there.
Yeah,
totally understand that. So okay, so I don't even know where I was going to go with the next with this question. I guess we're on to the next one, Court.
Yeah, that's also like you're creating the best segues ever into our questions. It's like you're following our without even trying.
So now, what do you look for exactly when you're signing a band? Like, what are the qualities that actually stick out to you?
I wouldn't say I've got anything like, I don't have a specific criteria because I'm not really like, I'm not fixed in like one genre or anything like that. I'm not like an elitist with, it has to be this type of metal. I think just whatever they're doing, they have to be doing it really well, I guess would be the only way to put it. If it's slam, then like it's got to really, really slam. If it's technical death metal and they call it tech, like there's a lot of bands calling themselves tech and it's just not technical, it's easy to play, so it's by definition not tech metal, you know. So the first thing is like, are they on top of what they think they are? Like a band's got an idea of what their sound is, where they sit, where they fit, what their aesthetic is. If that idea is unrealistic from the get-go, then I've learned from experience now, you can pretty much guarantee in 2 or 3 years when the band does have a bit of momentum and some heat behind them, they're going to start making some outrageous demands where you're like, are you kidding me sort of thing. So I guess when it comes to, if you're grabbing a band in their infancy, it's more about the work ethic because without touring and without actually being on top of their stuff, it's quite hard to get that first sort of momentum going. But I think again, it's sort of changed over the last few years, because we were quite open to signing smaller bands and development bands a couple years ago, but we've taken a lot of those on the last couple of years. So now I'm kind of on the hunt for, you know, bands that basically have like 100,000 monthly listeners on Spotify minimum, because we've got tons of bands that have, you know, 5,000, 10,000, 20, 50, 80, and some have 100, 150, but I want to get more of those heavy hitters on board, because they help propel the smaller bands, and they also reinforce the brand of the label itself. So,
fair.
Yeah. But if we're talking technicalities, like live show is really important. That, you know, image is important to a degree, in that they can't look awkward. That's my only thing. I don't really care about what they're wearing, or if it's makeup, or if, you know, whatever it might be, as long as it looks convincing. Yeah. Because sometimes you can have bands that go all out metal or whatever, and it's just cringe as fuck. And then you have the same aesthetic applied to bands who know what they're doing, and it's amazing. So like Behemoth, for example, is a perfect example. Like, they just nail that aesthetic. But I can think of a few examples where I've just been like, nope, straight away.
Yeah.
What do you? It's an individual thing, yeah.
So now, with a smaller band though, so like, let's say that you did come across a smaller band, for example, like, I know you said you want to get ones in the hundreds of thousands, but I mean, obviously if you see something that you think has potential, you might go. So what would be the exact qualities of a smaller band to get your attention nowadays?
There's a few things really. I guess if you're checking, we get through a lot of music each week as far as people sending stuff. So there's that sort of first listen factor, where I was thinking, you know, if I was on the other end and I wasn't running the label, I was just someone browsing through a playlist, or someone played something to me, like how quickly is this song hitting me? And if it is a slow mover and like a longer song, does it keep you engaged, like, to justify the length of the song? And I don't know, to be honest, there's no rule of thumb, man. Like, my brain's whizzing 100 questions, you know. I wouldn't say any rule defines each band, because I've been put off signing bands for one reason, and then I've had other bands that have signed where the same thing would apply, and I've been like, it doesn't really matter because their music's so good, or, you know. So I don't know, it is a tough one. One thing I would say is the point I made a little while ago about expectations from the artist's end, like, you can gauge what your relationship's going to be like with that band and what their work ethic's going to be like from the early conversations quite quickly.
Yeah.
And the amount of help they're going to need as well. Because obviously having a manager and a booking agent and, you know, a team behind a band always helps, because it means the band can focus on being a band.
Yeah. So you're looking for bands that are more self-reliant than looking for the label to be helping them.
Yeah. Yeah, cool. Definitely to an extent. I mean, there's a flip side to the coin in that once a band becomes so self-reliant that they're just on top of their shit, they don't need anything else, especially in this day and age where if you've got the right distribution, then that's basically it. If you're e-commerce savvy and you know how Shopify works and all of that, then you can sort of do your own brand quite easily. But I think where Unique Leaders sort of has a decent sort of staple point is within the sort of the pocket that we're in, each new edition we get on board, it builds it up for the other bands as well. So there's a collection of different kind of movements of bands that are kind of associated with each other now, or they're friends with each other, or they're always touring together, or they've guested on each other's albums, things like that. So that's quite exciting in itself, just to see those inter-band relationships grow as more go out on tour. There's definitely sort of a Unique Leader sound that people are talking about on YouTube now, which is that, I don't want to say sort of deathcore, but sort of modern death metal and a lot of the Blackened stuff and the modern sort of new deathcore stuff like Brand of Sacrifice and all that. We were kind of on top of that at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people were poo-pooing us for signing it, but it's just a breath of fresh air. You know, it's something different. So I think that would be another thing. If we're looking at a band, it's like, has this already been done, and has it been done better? Mm-hmm. If it has been done better, then who buy and what are their numbers like? You know, and you start looking at that and it's like, well, that's only done 5,000 copies worldwide, and this band wants like X amount of money, and you start have to weigh up the budgets, like, is it actually worth it? And if it always comes out as like a red line, or we're going to make, you know, a huge loss on this first album, you can only really, in my mind, justify it if the music is just amazing, because then you can argue like, okay, well, it's just not been pushed to the right market the right way yet. Because that has happened before. Bands have soft released albums by themselves, it's done nothing, or they've given it to the wrong label and it's done nothing, and then a re-release treatment comes back, or they'll make one tweak to their lineup, and it all just kicks off. Like Lorna Shore is a great example, you know.
Yeah.
As soon as Will joined the band, it was just hype city, and that was it. And that's all they needed, was just that little tweak.
No. Fair. So how do you kind of know that that's that type of a band, that they just need that extra? Is it, again, just a gut feeling? Is that all it is?
I think it's partly a gut feeling, but it's also quite easy to spot when a band's really gathering heat, especially if you're going to shows and you see a band that's on like the first or second out of five, and they're outselling every other band on the bill. And there's a huge pit and everyone knows the words. You're like, hang on a minute, like, what's going on here? You know? So if you want to be just stuck behind Spotify and like rely on metrics and data, there's some people who base a model on that, but I think you have to sort of weigh it up as well, because there's a lot of great bands that make awesome studio output and then you go and see them live and it sounds like a cat falling down a flight of stairs. So I think it all has to be approached with a bit of scrutiny. But sometimes there has been the odd, you know, gut signing where if a band's on the other side of the world and we can't watch them play, we'll go by video footage, or we'll go by what we can find.
So I guess you always want to see the live recordings no matter what before you sign something.
I would say so most of the time, yeah, unless a band's sort of unable to provide it for whatever reason, but that's kind of rare.
Understood. I think we're done on that question. So Corey, you're next.
Oh, that is true. Okay, so this is mostly just focusing on like smaller bands that didn't have the good luck to just go completely viral and bananas everywhere.
Yeah.
Why do you think it is that some bands can check all of the boxes and do pretty much all of the things right and still not end up getting signed by anybody? Aside from going, just like I said, completely viral and on their own, they got like a million listeners on Spotify.
Well, I think it's the context of the question that's important there. Like, I think a lot of bands that are doing really well by themselves don't actually want to be signed, if that makes sense. Like, they're so sort of happy with where they're at that they don't really see the need for it. So I think, you know, there's a few bands, for example, that might have gone through, like, I don't know, a network like Blood Blast, or, you know, just a label services deal with somebody where they could have retained all the rights to them and, you know, to their material and their songwriting, and rely on the current fan base they've already got. And they don't actually need the label to help elevate them to that point. So I think it's rare. I don't think you're ever going to find a band in their infancy that has all of those things you just mentioned where nobody's interested in signing them. I think the only time you're going to find a band with a large fan base and a large catalogue and good numbers, but no record deal, it's usually because there's a member of that band that's pissed everybody off to the point where no one wants to work with them anymore. Or they've been like semi-written off by the big players because they'll be like, well, this band's been around for 10 years already and they haven't really blasted through the gates yet. They're five albums in or whatever. But that can be a mistake too, because I've seen bands that have released a bunch of stuff and not really done anything. And then once they get a push behind them, they've done really well. So again, I don't think there's a magic formula. I don't think you can just reach into your hat and pull out like, okay, this is how you do it. This is the trajectory. I think it changes according to like where you fit in kind of subgenres as well, because every fan base is a little bit different, like how you respond to new music. You know, it's like a Chelsea Grin fan and a Deicide fan and a Hatebreed fan and a Brand of Sacrifice fan, they're all going to be completely different in terms of like the way they consume music, for example. So one's going to be more likely to be on a mobile phone, another is more likely to be maybe checking out Discogs or picking up a copy of Terrorize or Metal Hammer, or a bit more old school inclined. So again, yeah, just judge it by the individual, really. If there is a band that's failing and they've got all of the boxes ticked, if they're failing to get a record deal, it's probably a deliberate decision to not be signed, you know.
Fair. Now, just as a quick follow-up on that, just kind of curious on this. So, like, let's say that you find a band and they tick all the boxes for you, but it's kind of like personality-wise, you don't really feel that they jive. Would that still be someone? Would you consider signing them, even though personality-wise? Yeah.
Personality doesn't really bother me so much. It's just more about professionalism. Like, you could be a complete dick as a person, but if you're conducting your business professionally, then that's fine. It's not called a music friendship, you know what I mean? You're not signing contracts to like be friends with people. Obviously, if you can build friendships, then even better. And I can say confidently that the majority of the relationships we've had with bands have been really good, and we've actually built some lifelong friends from it. But then we've also dealt with some complete chodes as well, where I've been happy to work with them on a professional basis, but I've been like, I would never hang out with you in a million years, you know.
Fair. How important do you think networking is to getting signed then?
To getting signed? It's a hard one. I mean, if you're releasing stuff yourself and you're using all the tools that bands have now, I don't think it's that important, because everyone goes and uses the same platforms for discovery. As far as, you know, if you know someone at Radio One or someone at Kerrang or whatever, and you can get that first head up, you know, then great. As they say, you know, it's all about who you know and all that bullshit. But I think there's plenty of bands who don't know anyone in the industry who have managed to just sort of catch plenty of people's eye just off the back of their music or their live show. And I think those are the ones that really should be taken seriously when you've got like organic hype building, not just some tastemaker in air quotes saying, this is the next whatever, or this is the hottest record. It's like, let the people decide, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Nope. I totally understand. I think that's all I got on that question, Corey.
All right. Well, that's all I had on that question too. And so we're going to actually switch gears just ever so slightly away from getting signed and go into touring, which is like the hot topic of will they, won't they? It's like the, you know, cheesy romance of the industry right now of, is this going to happen or not? How are you guys dealing with the current restrictions for touring? And do you think touring will be coming back outside of the US? Because I know here it's like the Wild West and nobody cares. Do you think it'll be coming back outside the US this year?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I mean, there's tours being announced for late spring, early summer this year. And as far as I'm aware, there's a few runs in January that have been postponed to March, kind of thing. But I don't want to kind of jinx it, but I think this will be the last year of real problems that we're getting. But don't quote me on that. But yeah, hopefully it's going to sort itself out a bit. I mean, a lot of the tours from 2021 were postponed to this year and they've just been moved back. So now bands have all got their eyes on 2023. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of the smart bands are using this time to make new music and new assets and using the time as a sort of blessing, really, to get prepared. Because a lot of the time it's against you, really. Deadlines can be against you.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is something that I do want to point out, is a lot of bands I've noticed have been using the time wisely to put out some pretty amazing music over the past couple of years.
Yeah. And I think the ones who have been, you can see how they've progressed considerably, like with their monthly numbers and stuff, the ones who've been active. Whilst the ones who haven't, you know, their numbers have dropped off.
100%. So I just have a question for you now. I think the UK, your restrictions are basically off, correct? Or am I mistaken on that?
No, there are still restrictions. I think it's more in Scotland. I think there are no, you can't go to any clubs and things like that at the moment. And there's no events, group events and stuff like that. But to be honest, I think over the next couple of months, we're probably going to see a lot of the shows being cancelled or postponed. But I think by the time we get to the second half of the year, it should have picked itself back up again. And I say by 2023, we should be back to normal. But it did hit us hard, yeah. For a couple of years, not having any bands on the road was absolutely fucking crippling.
You know? How do you kind of deal with that as a label then? Like, if you can't depend on bands to tour?
We just did the best we could, but obviously you can't do as good a job with an album release as when there's tours behind it. So some bands wanted their albums out irrespective of being on tour or not. You know, for different reasons. But if we put an album out without any tours behind it, it can be tricky.
Yeah. So I guess, what about the vinyl shortage and stuff like that? How are you guys dealing with that plus the touring?
That's another whole other hell entirely.
Yeah. It's everything.
There's basically a 6 to 9 month backlog on vinyl as well. So we've had releases, for example, that came out in September, October last year, that still haven't had vinyl stock delivered yet.
Yeah.
There's nothing you can do. It's like an industry-wide problem. So, the issue is, there's one company that has pretty much 85 to 90% of all vinyl manufacturing traffic, and all of the other companies go through that company as a sister company. So until they let go of some of the restrictions, you know, on the usage of certain machines and stuff, it's just going to be a problem that we're going to face for the foreseeable. I think it's not going to change. So what we're doing now is, when we announce an album, we'll have the digital and CD releases as the release date, and then we'll announce the vinyl format and that it's coming, but we won't announce the street date until we get a confirmed date back from the supplier.
Makes sense. Do you guys, just curiosity, do you guys sell more vinyl than CD, or is it more CD?
I'd say now it's leaning more towards vinyl. I'd say it's about 60-40 physical to digital.
And then, oh, really?
about 60% of that physical is vinyl, yeah.
So you're getting about 40% of the physical sales are CDs right now?
It varies. I mean, CDs are kind of on their way out slowly, like just a couple of percent a year, it's just dropping. But the market is still there, but it's not like it was when it was the dominant format, that's for sure.
Fair enough. Just curious on that, because I've heard differing things from different labels. Like, some will say, tell me that, you know, CDs, they sell more than vinyl, and never know.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite a hard one. I think if we were to sort of look at all of our sales over the year between all the formats, I think it would be pretty evenly matched between the three.
Yeah.
But with digital going the way it's going, we've seen that percentage creep up from like 30 to 40 to 50%. So I think physical is slowly on its way out as far as CDs, I think. But vinyl will always be around, just because it's got that collectible culture. Like, even cars now don't, you know, they're not being manufactured with CD decks in them, but they come with Apple Play or whatever.
Yep.
So, you know, I think the whole manufacturing industry is kind of against CD consumption in general, in terms of how it could be used in your house, in your car. You know, no one can really be bothered to burn someone a CD anymore. Who's even got a CD drive on their computer? Not many people. Like, so there's quite a lot of factors into it now. But when it comes to vinyl, people like to have it as a collectible or a display item. They might not even listen to it. They just want the physical item to own, and then they'll listen to it by streaming.
Yeah.
Which, for me, that's the best way to support a band, is buy their vinyl and then just stream the fuck out of their music constantly. Like, every time you want to listen to it, stream it, because they get paid every time that way. And then they've already been paid as well for the album sale.
Yeah. So
that's like the best way, I think.
I agree.
The approach that I take, it's like with CDs and really any physical media, I'm going to be inconvenienced no matter how it is that I'm using it. I'm going to have a special player for a CD or a vinyl or whatever. So if I'm going to be inconvenienced to listen to my music, I'm going to get one that's really cool looking.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think we went almost are out of questions, or we are out of questions rather, but I have a fine one more that I have for you actually. So what is your own personal preference for formats anyway, just like as a personal thing, CD, vinyl, or digital, or what?
In order, it would be digital, vinyl, CD.
Interesting.
I've got a large vinyl collection, but when it comes to listening to music, I listen digitally most of the time, purely because a lot of the releases that I put on would be double vinyl albums. Mm-hmm. So I'll have to turn the disc over like twice when I want to listen to the album. Like every three songs, I've got to flip it over. So it's just easier for me to have playlists on and that sort of thing. But
super awesome like vintage vinyl changers. So I put like a stack of five, and then I just pull a stack every
yeah, that's cool,
whatever.
Those are awesome as well. Yeah, I mean,
for a changer, those are fun.
I can see the appeal behind listening to vinyl, because it gives you a more immersive process. The whole thing is, you know, you're taking this vinyl and you're going to put that on your player, you're just going to listen to that, you're not going to skip anything, you know, you're fully immersed into it. But when you're listening to the amount of music that I'm having to plow through a week, it's just easier. Digital is just the one for me. Just because I've got my collection all filtered into genres and stuff like that as well on my iTunes, and then my Spotify is all kind of pure OCD as well. So,
yep.
For me, it's easier. And the other thing is I can sync it to, you know, if I've got like a playlist I've made where, for example, Test Masters, when we get our, you know, final masters back before they go to the vinyl plant, I can put that onto my phone, for example, and listen to it in my car as like another form of speakers to test them out. I can put them on my AirPods. I can whack them wherever I want. Whilst with the vinyl, really, you're only going to get the best form of that if you're sticking headphones on or if you're sitting down and listening to it. So, yeah, that's why my leaning on it is buy the vinyl, then you've got it to enjoy, but then just listen to the music on Spotify or Tidal or whatever you want for that.
And they get double paid at the same time, which benefits the band.
Yeah.
Boom. And then also, you guys don't do cassettes, do you?
We are about to, actually. We're going to... Just the Zoom thing being pushed to next week, same damn time. Cool. I'm not in a rush now, so that's good. Cool. Yeah, we are going to do the entire catalogue on tape. We were speaking to different suppliers, engaging the demand for it a bit, because we've had mixed sort of feedback from people on how it's gone, but we are going to do it, yeah, because they're quite cheap to make.
I feel like it's super big in the thrash circle.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
that's the one that you can see the most traction in cassettes.
Yeah, we've got a band called Extinction AD that we just signed quite recently that are very thrashy, so we'll probably do a tape for them.
That's awesome. I was going to ask you a question about cassettes, and now my brain just fucking froze on me here. Corey, over to you.
I'm actually going to be seeing Extinction AD in like, 13 days or something like that. So I'm pretty jazzed.
Nice. Is that on the cattle tour?
Yep. I'm going to the cattle tour. And then I'm also going to the Chaos and Carnage. I'm going to that one. So I'll see what Distant from your roster too.
Yeah. When does this... broadcast?
Probably today or tomorrow.
Oh, okay. I can't tell you who the special guest is then.
Either way, I'm going, so.
Yeah, no, that's one of the best lineups I've seen in ages. That's like what Summer Slaughter was back in like 2008, which is pretty much.
I'm going to be so bruised and broken after that show, because I will not leave the pit, like, period. It's not going to happen. And I'm so
looking forward to it.
Cool.
What else do we
have for Jamie, Corey?
Well, I have one final question if you don't have any others.
Well, Jamie, let me ask you this. What do you think that listeners should know or bands should know, considering that we basically are geared for people that are trying to learn more about the industry? What is some piece of advice or some pearl of wisdom that you can give that we haven't asked you about?
What, just in general, like a takeaway, a parting gift?
Something that we haven't asked you about that you think people should know who are looking to break into the industry.
in terms of like breaking into the industry in general, just finding your feet and where you belong in it and what your trajectory is and all of that, I'll just say, just stick to whatever your passion is, where, you know, it's that age old thing. Like if you enjoy what you do for a job, you never work a day in your life and all that. It does apply to a degree. I think if you're really good, you know, creative writing, it makes sense to go into PR or music journalism or working for a magazine or something that involves utilizing that skill. I would say the same would apply to anything else. But in terms of actually getting your foot in, that's, I guess, the sort of magic question, really. You know, yep. if there was a book for that, it would probably be a bestseller, you know, how to get a job in the music biz. But I think networking is obviously important. A strong knowledge of the music that you want to actually specialize in. You can't really sort of be, oh, I want to be in the industry. Why? Just so you can say I'm in the music industry, then, you know, you just sound like sort of everybody else who wants to work in Hollywood or music. Or yep. If you're not passionate about it, then people will see straight through that straight away. Like when I went to Terrorizer, they did the sort of whole corporate interview thing. And then once we got that out of the way, I just got grilled on death metal and black metal for about 45 minutes. And the fact I was still there after an hour and they were still asking me, I was like, okay, I think I've got this job, because I knew what the editor was like. He's a mercenary when it came to, he couldn't stand posers. You know what I mean? Like people who waltz in and go, oh, I'm mad into this type of metal or that metal or whatever. And then he'd be like, oh, cool. Like, what's your favorite so-and-so album? And he wouldn't even say it in a dick way to be like, oh, I'm going to test this guy and see, you know. But there have been instances where, you know, I've seen people quizzed on stuff that they allegedly know a lot about and they just crumbled. So I guess it's quite a humbling industry in that respect, in that there's always somebody doing what you do better than you do it. So yeah. if you can surround yourself with people who you aspire to be like, you know, in terms of, oh, if I ever have a PR company like that guy, or if I've ever got a consultancy company like she has, or whatever it is, that usually leads to like a code of practice, I find, because that's how it was for me. At One Little Indian, I looked at Derek and I was like, this guy is just the coolest guy on earth. He's like, you know, absolute punk, driving a big Mercedes Defender thing. Mm-hmm. Like a G-Wagon, and he's just signing whatever band he wants and whistles off to America to go and meet so-and-so in this band and this band. And it wasn't cool because of the names or the people he was meeting. Like, I didn't care about, oh, it's this rock star or that. It's the fact that he was sort of so well-respected by the artists he was working with that they genuinely cared about his input and what he wanted to sort of put forward. If there was something in the sound he didn't like or the artwork or whatever it was, he'd be very vocal about it and quite unapologetic about it, in that, like, if it's said with conviction, I think that's what gets through to artists. If you're trying to say, oh, we need to change this or this because it's going to sell you more records, that's not a good reason. It's like, why is it going to sell more records? Like, get right to the nitty gritty of it, you know? So I guess to summarize, that would be just have a real attention to detail. Like, if you're looking for something specific, narrow it down even further. Like, if you want to be in PR, what type of PR, like, specifically, do you want to do, you know, focus on, like, on radio, or do you want to focus on online or regional or national, or do you want to do all of that stuff together? Do you want to just do it for metal, or do you want to do it for a bit of metal and a bit of everything else and network into other parts of the industry? Because you might not want to work in metal your whole life, or you might, you know what I mean? Like, I don't particularly want to do any other genres, even though I listen to loads of other stuff.
Fair.
This is my sort of where I sit, so.
Totally.
Yeah. But again, man, like, I can't give you sort of definitive answers on anything, really. It's all down to the individual and where their comfort zone is and where they sit with their peers and the goals you're setting for yourself, really.
Wonderful. I do have one more follow-up question. Are you okay on time now? You said you had. Okay, cool. Sorry to keep you so long, but you just keep giving good answers. But just back to networking, just super quickly here. So, like, a lot of people do fail in the networking department. Like, I know me and Corey will get people reach out to us, and I'm sure you get the same thing, where it's kind of like, you don't, you can tell right away you don't want to respond to that person. So what would be your tip when people are reaching out to other people in the industry, like a newer person, on how to get their attention across just the book, I guess?
Nice balance of professionalism and well-written email. Like if you just come out like, hey man, or hey dude, or whatever, I'm instantly like, what the fuck? I don't know. I think it's that classic, you know, when you're at school and they teach you how to write a letter, there's a certain way to kind of open a dialogue with someone. And I think you can, you can gauge quite a lot by how they deal with that. The one I hate the most is when people just go, they'll send an email with like no subject on it. It'll just be a link, and then it'll be like, let me know, or I'll be like, well, what the fuck, you know, I won't even click on it, I'll just be like, delete, you know. So yeah, I guess it would be like, if you're applying for a job, or you know, get as much of yourself or the band or whatever it is into one package that isn't coming across like a soliloquy.
Fair. Cool. Okay, so I think I'm out of questions. Corey, do you have anything else?
I do. I have one final question, and it is the most important question. This question separates the men from the boys. It is, I can't stress how important it is.
Okay.
What is your favorite dinosaur?
Velociraptor.
Ah. Classic. It is a classic choice. Let me guess, because of Jurassic Park, the first one?
They just remind me of if they were a dog, they'd be a Doberman, if you know what I mean. There's something about them. If in terms of a pet, I wouldn't really want one for a pet.
But what if it was really well behaved with you, and then you could just like, you know, somebody irritates you, and you can just send a doctor after him.
Have a go. Yeah. Yeah. That would be cool. Yeah, I think they've always sort of fascinated and terrified the shit out of me since I was a kid, since Jurassic Park came out and he pulled out the sort of the claw and held it up to the kid's shirt. But yeah, in terms of not being a dick, just any vegetarian one's fine by me, just so I don't get eaten.
Yeah. Have you ever heard of the Utah Raptor?
I haven't.
It's basically the Velociraptor, but double the size.
Really?
It's like a giant version of the Velociraptor. So
I'm waiting for the punchline.
Nope, there's no punchline. It is just a gigantic version, like where the Velociraptor has the 6-inch claw. This one has a 12-inch, like retractable claw.
It's a well-endowed Velociraptor.
It's just a massive Velociraptor. So something for you to Google after the podcast. Go look up the gigantic Utah Raptor.
Nice.
So with that,
all my questions.
Well, with that, we're going to end off the podcast. Thank you very much, Jamie, for coming on. It was super appreciated. And with that,
thanks for having me.
Perfect. And with that, party on, Corey.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please help spread the word by leaving us a 5-star review on your platform of choice. You can also join the conversation by following us on any social media and suggesting guests or topics you'd like to learn more about. Thanks for listening to C Squared.